Hey, our worship team has had a busy, fun day as they've led worship over at U City, some good friends of ours, and we're grateful to be part of a church that helps with the church around our city, and grateful for the opportunity for us to be able to help other churches and invest in that, and so we're just grateful for them. So they've had a long day, so we got a couple more songs here in a little bit after I share, but just encourage them in how God's been able to use their giftings to encourage others around our city, and I'm glad you're here tonight. So I'm Jack, I'm one of the pastors here. Welcome if you're brand new, you're kind of jumping into a series we've been called The Good Life, looking at and through the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to be in chapter 4 and the first part of chapter 5 tonight. If you do have a phone and you want to kind of follow along on YouVersion, actually put all the sermon scriptures and the slides and kind of all the information in there. A lot of my notes are in there too. You can follow along if you want. So we just go to YouVersion Bible app. It's a free app you can download. Click on live events. Look for elements. There you are. So y'all glad to be here tonight? Good. How many of you watch the nightly news or any kind of news online? How many of you watch most of the news online? Curious. Okay, how many of you watch like a nightly news show on TV type thing? Just curious. I don't know if you've seen this pattern that has happened on the news really over the last decade or so. It's kind of like they start the news story with like the breaking news, right? And the breaking news is usually almost always, what, good news or bad news? Bad news, right? And so you sit down maybe after dinner and you're kind of there and you watch the news and you're like, wow, that was depressing. And then you go through stories and stuff like that. And it seems like just every story after story after story, just it's more bad news, right? They're just kind of serving that up. And then you find out your sports team lost and that's sad. But our sports team, Arizona, what? That's awesome. So there's lots of, you know, suck offset type thing. And then at the very end of all the news, at the very last, in the last 30 seconds, 45 seconds, they always do what? One feel-good story, right? It's like a, you know, dog wagging their tail. I mean, there's never a cat because you wouldn't do that. But it's just like there's a dog maybe there's a cat. But there's maybe like the soldier comes home. There's like a feel-good story at the end because they know this, that they're just serving up bad news. And they're like, well, we want you to tune back in tomorrow. Here's a puppy. And so they're like, ah, we left you on a happy note, so you'll come back. And I want you to kind of keep that in mind a little bit as we look into the first part of chapter 4. And tonight's going to be a little bit more mechanical feeling, a little bit more kind of survey through this text in chapter 4. We're going to kind of pick it apart a little bit and looking at chapter 5. And I want you to see something juxtaposed in a way that how he starts chapter 4 and how he starts chapter 5 kind of puts this tension and this choice before us. In Solomon, we've kind of said throughout Ecclesiastes, he's kind of blunt. And in a lot of ways, he's kind of serving up an assessment of this life experiment that he did, where he pursued every pleasure and everything that he can get his hands on, mind around to find the good life. And at the very end of this book, he will finally point it out, like point blank, here's how you find the good life. And he's kind of giving little snippets here and there in between as we go. But I want you to look at what he says here in verse 1, and I'm going to read this out of the New Living Translation. Here's what he says. And it's kind of dark. It's kind of tough. And here's what he says. Again, I observed that the oppression that takes place under the sun. Remember, under the sun is just the worldly way of life that goes on. And he's kind of giving this assessment that's there. I saw the tears of the oppressed with no one to comfort them. The oppressors had great power and their victims were helpless. So I concluded that the dead are better off than the living. But most fortunate are those who are yet to be born, for they have not seen all the evil that is done under the sun. Well, that's how you start a sermon. That seems depressing. And I think that's the point. It seems worrisome. It seems to build this anxiety within us. When we assess life under the sun, when we give this assessment to what goes on around us. And I don't think there's any one of us here that hasn't watched the news, whether you watch online or read about it online or just follow along in the world, that you look around the world and you realize from the simple stories of maybe the person that you know that their child is in the cancer hospital, all the way up to refugees being forced out of their country and having to live on the road and on the go, and under military hunt, so to speak, and everything in between, that we live in a world that in a lot of ways, for as much technology advancements we've made in the last 3,000 years, what Solomon said 3,000 years ago still rings true, doesn't it? That he's just pointing out the reality of life, and he's already said, hey, things come and things go, and there's kind of this cycle to life, and if you just live for under the sun, if you just spend your life kind of looking to what you can gain underneath the sun, here's what you're going to find. It's just rough. It's tough. It's you see this oppression that goes on, and yes, there's glimpses of hope, and there's glimpses of goodness, and there's glimpses of what God is up to, and there's things as believers of those who have trusted their life to Christ, who now we are called to be the light of the world, to bring God's light and his hope and his love into the darkness that is around us. And there's glimpses of that. But when you just survey the whole landscape, you kind of get to the place where you're feeling like when you're watching the news. It's just depressing. One story after another, and yeah, okay, a dog wagged its tail, big deal. You ever felt that way in life where you're just kind of like, I don't get it. Why are we still here? Jesus, why haven't you come back yet? Like, it's just, how can God watch all this go on? And that's one of the great questions of life that people have wrestled with and argued around and tried to figure out an answer to. And I think Solomon's getting to this place where if you just saw life the way it was, in broad strokes, and everywhere from revolutions to oppression to everything in the traffic industry to everything that goes on, you could just go mad. And I think that's what he's saying, is you could get so worried about stuff where you kind of lose hope at life under the sun. And isn't that kind of the point that he's been hinting at the whole way through this book, is that maybe there's something different than just seeing life as life under the sun? Maybe there's a different vantage point, a different perspective to look at. And there's this oppression. It's looking at the brokenness of humanity, this extreme brokenness. And then he kind of, at the first part of chapter 5, and I just want to see the bookends of this. He's highlighting the brokenness of humanity. And then he's going to highlight the beauty of humility. And the humility of looking to someone who is above the sun, someone who stands above the brokenness of humanity in a sovereign, unshakable stance. And the only one who stands with that sovereign, unshakable stance is God. It's not you, by the way. It's not me, for sure. The only one who's there is God. And he whispers these words, which are powerful words. I didn't want to skip over them. As he says this in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 1 through 2, he says, look, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. When you go before God, remember they had a whole temple that they would walk up these steps, and the steps were just absolutely enormous walking up to this temple mount that would have been there. And he says, I want you to kind of guard your steps when you walk to the house of God. He says, go near to listen rather than offer the sacrifice of fools. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. So you let your words be few. And it's fascinating when you see these things kind of put next to each other. Here's the brokenness of humanity that it just, in a lot of ways, just is a sucker punch to the gut sometimes when you just survey the world. And yet, there's this other beautiful side of humility when we're allowed to approach God and say, God, I'm so glad that you stand in a sovereign, steady stance above this. And I'm so glad that you understand how to navigate this, that I don't have to figure out this. So I'm just going to go over here and I'm going to put my focus on you. And I think that's kind of what Solomon is maybe hinting at here a little bit as we navigate life, is you can spend your life with a focus either on all the worry of all the brokenness of humanity and how you make your way around it and how you navigate it. Or you can take the vantage point that says, I'm going to put my heart focused on worship. And I'm going to see God for who God is. Not the God I try to want him to be, but for the God who he really is. He is above all. And he stands above the humanity's mess. And he's able to say, I love this, even with all the heartache and the turmoil and the evil that goes on. He's able to say, I've made a way for you to escape this, that you don't have to live life under the sun, and that's it. That there's a different complexity, a different opportunity, a different invitation for you to experience maybe life above the sun. And I think sometimes it's important for us to experience that and to hold on to that, to understand that, yes, we live in a world that's incredibly broken. And that can be really overwhelming and cause a lot of anxiety and worry if we just let our focus be on that. But at the same time, I think sometimes we live in this complexity and we forget the fact that God is so far above this. And sometimes we're so fast to approach God, and God is friend, and he is that. But he is so much more than that. He is so much more above that, that he's the creator of our world. He's the creator of your world. He understands you, and he is beside you, and he is with you. But friend, he is far, far above you, and far, far above me. And I think what he desires is for a heart of humility to come before him, not in trembling fear, but in true awe. Of true awe to say, God, I don't understand how you can watch this and seemingly not respond, though I know you do. And I know you call us as believers and as light in this world to respond. And I don't understand how it all works, but I wonder if there's this tension that has to exist and this call between us all the time to say, God, am I going to let my focus be on all the worry, or am I going to let my focus be on worship and the fact that I don't have to worry, that you stand above this and that it's okay. This beautiful reminder that I can get caught up in worry or I can get caught up in worship. And there's this invitation throughout the scriptures for us to get caught up in this worship. Now, I want to go back to chapter 4 and kind of work our way through a little bit of this, because I think what Solomon is getting at here in this next section, coming out of this idea of the brokenness of humanity, and before we get to the idea of being caught up in this wonderful worship of who God is and he's far above, is he has this tension that we have to wrestle with, this tug of war for the human heart in a way. My daughter has Spirit Week this last week at school, and they had to do this giant tug of war. Anyone ever participated in a tug of war before? What's the key in tug of war, besides having bigger people on your side? And gloves. Gloves really do help. Leverage, right? Leverage is what really matters in a tug of war, that you have to have this leverage of understanding, okay, if I get more leverage on this side, then this team is going to slide. That's how it works. It's the same way in football. It's the same way in other sports that are played, that it doesn't have to necessarily be the bigger person, though that does help. It's all about leverage. It's about where you get this. And I think what Solomon's getting ready to say through chapter 4 and what he's going to look at for us is, hey, there's some things that want to gain leverage in your life. And there's some pulls, there's some tug of war going on for the human heart that he's going to highlight for us to see. And what he wants us to see is, look, there's going to be this pull of envy that's going to come up in your life. There's going to be this pull of foolishness, this of laziness, of just kind of letting go and just doing whatever and trying to be dependent on other people and not take any responsibility for yourself. And there's going to be these pulls in the human heart. But what you have to understand is that the real leverage toward the good life is found when you live with the pull of community. And you let that be what gains leverage into your life. And you want that to be something that is pointing you towards something better. So here's what he says in Ecclesiastes 4, verse 4. He says, here's that first pull that's going to want to pull at the human heart. He says it's this pull of envy. He says, and I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. And see, the truth is that envy will want to rise up in your life and in mine. It's when we are not careful, it can begin to kind of put down some roots and begin to gain leverage within the human heart to say, I want what other people have. I want to achieve or I want to accomplish or I want to experience what other people have. They've done studies on, you know, we're all kind of wired and socially media connected, and that's a good thing. There's a lot of good that comes from it. But here's what they've found, that one of the primary emotions that's stirred up as people navigate social media is envy. That people struggle to celebrate with others, or they even get a little bit sideways in the character of their heart when they begin to celebrate the misfortune of those who are perfect in their eyes, who seem to have it all together and have it all there, but then they watch the downfall of something unfold in their life, and there's a secret part of your heart that you go, oh, I'm so glad that happened to them. And I know you would never raise your hand to say that's you, but would you raise your hand on the inside if that's you? If you've ever done that? If you've ever come to the place where you've said, hey, you know, there's a sad part of my heart that actually celebrates that a little bit. When I feel like the people who have had it all, who have all the good looks, who have all the money, who have all that kind of stuff, and then something transpires in their life, there's kind of a sick part of me that goes, finally. You know? And I think if we're honest, I think there's parts of our heart that have a tendency in the human condition in life under the sun where we want to actually grab hold of that, or we want to live with this idea of envy pulling and gaining roots and leverage into our heart to say, God, I just wish they would get something, or I wish I could have, or I wish I could experience, or I wish I could get what they have. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what Solomon's pointing out is, listen, the chasing after the stuff, after the experiences, it's not a bad thing to chase, but you want to be careful that envy isn't beginning to try to gain leverage into your life, because that's what he's noticing, is that for some people, it's beginning to gain leverage into their life. And he says there's this opposite pull, this other tug of war. If you're having a tug of war, there's got to be two things that are kind of pulling. He says this other one is this pull of foolishness, of kind of this laziness. Here's what he says, Ecclesiastes 4:5. It says, fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. They have the folding of their hands and they ruin themselves. What he's talking about is foolish people, Solomon is saying, live irresponsibly. They live with an idle heart, not chasing after idols. They're stuck in neutral. They don't want to do anything for themselves. They've come to a place where they want to throw in the towel, so to speak, in life. Whether drama or tragedy is unfolding in their life and they say, I just can't deal anymore. And they say, I'm waving the white flag and I'm done. And I just want to check out, and I just want other people to take care of me. And they get to this place where it becomes really interesting in what's going on, this struggle that says, hey, I want to have other people. And maybe you've known people around you who, in some way, shape, or form, it's not just a tough spot in life where everyone has seasons of that, where we need other people around us, but this has kind of become a pattern in their life where they're saying, hey, I need you guys to do this for me, and I need you to do for this. And there's always this asking. It's like there's this codependency side beginning to foster up in their life. And Solomon's saying this is kind of like foolishness. This is kind of like this laziness pull in the human heart that wants to pull at you and say, hey, you don't have to take responsibility for yourself. You can just kind of mooch off others. And I think we all kind of know, maybe identifying people like that, or maybe we've had seasons in our own life and how in a lot of ways that seems nice, because then you don't have to take responsibility. You don't have to take responsibility for the bad decisions in life. You can kind of pass the blame on to someone else, or you could say, hey, play more of the victim role. And there's this challenge that goes on with this. And Solomon is speaking some heavy things here. He says, look, there's this tug of war that's going to go on for the human heart. And envy is going to want to pull at you. And this foolishness is going to want to pull at you. But wise people see something different. Wise people begin to realize that the pull of envy and the pull of foolishness will ultimately pull you toward isolation. And no one benefits or prospers alone. You cannot do it. And though you may want to be a renegade, and though you may want to be a Lone Ranger, and though you may want to be the person who is just off by themselves because no one else is doing it right or no one else is helping, I'm just going to do it on my own. Friend, you can try that. Go for it. But my hunch is, somewhere along the line, you're going to wake up and realize what Solomon realized. See, Solomon had all the power he could ever want, right? Had all the leverage, resource-wise, financially, lived in a giant palace surrounded by people. But I think he's tapping into something within his own heart of realizing, I may be surrounded by people, but I'm not connected with anyone. And I think there's a giant, massive difference. In fact, we talk about it here. One of our values of living this connected life, not just the surrounded life, of saying, hey, life is not just about being around a bunch of people, but actually living life connected with people, because you need people and people need you. And what Solomon is beginning to drive home is, look, this pull of envy and this pull of foolishness, it will lead you to isolation, and you're the one who loses in the end. But there's another pull, but it's one you have to pull. It's not something that's going to come after your heart. You have to give your heart to it, and you have to pledge your life to it. But as you do, it will begin to leverage its way into your heart, into your life, and you'll begin to experience more and more of the good life as you live relationally connected to others. Solomon's driving this whole chapter, this place, this last section of chapter 4 of what he's driving to, of understanding and emphasizing the great gift of relationships, of living a connected life with others. There's great benefits that come from that. In fact, he begins to point out a few of these things. I'll look at 4. Solomon's saying, hey, look, there's these 4 benefits that come with this idea of living a connected life, and you don't have to. You could choose to live in isolation by envy or isolation by foolishness or just isolation, giving way and saying, I don't want wisdom. And you can say, I'm not going to live in a connected life. I'm just going to live my own solo life. But you will be the one who loses in that. There's a gentleman, Marcus Pearson, who created Minecraft. When Minecraft was a game, for those of you who are gamers, understand that. And he sells this off to Microsoft for $2.5 billion. Can I get an amen? Like, that's a lot of money, right? $2.5 billion. You think you'd like that in your bank account? $2.5 billion. And he goes into the whole party lifestyle and he understands all this. And then it's interesting. You can read about it online. He begins kind of tweeting out these ecclesiastical type sayings as he's experiencing life now as a retired young person. And here's a couple of the tweets he sends. He says, hanging out with a bunch of friends and partying with famous people, able to do whatever and whenever I want, I have never felt more isolated. Money doesn't buy everything, does it? We live in a culture that preaches differently. But I think the reality is we know differently. We know that to be true. I found a great girl, he says, but she was afraid of me and my lifestyle and went with a normal person instead. And you hear the longing in his heart, this incredible successful person by Solomon's standards, incredibly successful, and yet realizing what Solomon stumbled into 3,000 years earlier. This life experiment isn't about the stuff. It's about relationships, and it's about this connection that we have with that. And he begins to point this out. He goes on here, verse 7 and 8. He says, again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil. Yet his eyes were never content with his wealth. He was just always pursuing more, and he didn't have anyone to share it with. And he comes to this place. He says, living this connected life is all about understanding that friends and family are for sharing. They're for helping you share life and share experiences, and that's where the blessing comes from. It's not just in the stuff being acquired. It's understanding these things and being able to share. See, what good is a boat that rots in the docks if you can never go out with friends and family to celebrate out on the lake? What good are golf clubs if you never get to go with anyone else and they just sit in your garage? What good are the things that you can own and things that you can attain that you don't have experiences with people? See, the blessing comes not from getting, but from sharing and from giving. And that's why I think one of the reasons God is the most joyful force in this world, because he's the most generous. God's middle name could be generosity, because he just lives by grace, and he pours his grace out for people, and he pours blessing into people, to good people and bad people too. And he just blesses, and he wants his kids to experience life. And he says, look, this is about sharing. And it really comes down to that. Solomon's pointing out, hey, this is about living this connected life. Secondly, where friends and family are helpful and are able to serve one another. They're helpful and able to serve. He says, look, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If one falls, the other can help him up. But pity the person who falls and doesn't have anyone to help them up. It's this idea that I get to live a serving lifestyle where I can serve those around me, and I can also experience the blessing of having other people serve and speak and invest into me relationally, that we live connected, that we need people, that life will have its wins and has its losses. It will have its peaks and it will have its valleys. And what you benefit in all aspects of life is when you get to share that and serve that alongside people that you're living life with. And that's what Solomon's speaking to. He says, look, you need people. So here's the question for you. Who served you well in life? Who has God put around your life that has served you well, that has shared with you? And maybe a follow-up question is, who is God putting around your life that he's asking you to share with, asking you to serve? Because I think that's what Solomon's driving to. Is he saying, look, this is about relational connection and living the connected life. Thirdly, he goes on, friends and family are about comforting one another. This is about meeting people where they're at. Verse 11, he says this, also, if two lie together, then keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And this isn't this idea of, okay, I'm going to snuggle in a bug and we're both in a sleeping bag, and that's awesome. This is about the idea of living life where I'm able to be with someone, and I'm able to walk with them, and I'm able to be alongside them as a friend or as a part of a family, in an aspect where I can experience life with them, where they're not alone. And see, technology says, well, I can know a lot about people, and I can write a Facebook status, and I can update and say, hey, I'm praying for you, or I'm thinking of you, and that's a good thing, and that's a blessing in our culture that we have that. But it's not the only thing. There is nothing like the ministry of presence, where you just show up and you're with people. Do you ever think about when you go to a hospital, why they have a chair next to the bed? I think it's because everyone knows innately that it's not about a phone call in that moment. It's not about flowers showing up. Those are nice things, and they're good, and they're necessary. It's not bad. But what's best is someone sitting in the chair next to someone who's in the bed and says, I'm just going to be here. I'm going to practice the ministry of presence. I'm just going to be here. I don't have answers for you. I don't have a what's next. I don't have a game plan. I'm just going to be in the midst of this turmoil with you. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. That you're just there, and then practicing this ministry of presence is such a blessing. So here's my question to you. Who has blessed you that way throughout your life? Think back over the landscape of your life. Who has blessed you and come and comforted you when you needed it? And then the follow-up question is, who might God be stirring around you and asking you to come and comfort them? To step into their life, into their world a little bit, to kind of sit in the chair next to what's going on in their life. And you're able to be a comforting part of the ministry of God's presence in their life just by your presence around them. Who can you step into for that? Then he goes on to verse 12. He says, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. Though one may be overpowered, two can stand up. It's kind of like the when you tell someone, hey, I've got your back, or in the military terms, I've got your six. I'm behind you. I'm with you. It's this idea of saying friends and family are there to protect. They're there to stand beside and to stand with and to stand against the things that come in this life, because there are going to be those valleys in life and it's going to be these challenges. And Solomon's saying, look, you need people like that who've got your back and who are protecting you, and that you can turn and in turn protect them and help be a force in their life. And so here's my question. Who has done that for you? And the follow-up is, who is God stirring in your life that you might need to step in and help protect them? A friend, family member, where you can be useful and be useful by God to say, hey, I'm going to be this. I'm going to actually exercise this idea of living the connected life, of saying the pull of community is what I want to major in. What I want to let go of is this pull of envy that begins to tug at my heart. And I want to let go of this pull of foolishness that begins to try to tug at my heart. And I want to hold on and pull the rope of community. And how do I begin to go do that? How do I serve? How do I share? How do I protect? How do I comfort those around me? And friends, this is where I believe the church should be, can be, and is at times the most powerful force on the planet, because we get to live this out the best way we know how. And when the church is functioning in a healthy way, it is the most powerful force on the planet. That's why Jesus established it. And he said, I'm going to build a movement. And this movement is the church, and it's people who begin to understand what Solomon is hitting at. That it's about relationships, and it's about love, and it's about hope, and it's about being into others and being able to encourage them and to build them up and to challenge them in proper ways and to be able to steer their life and to travel life with them, where they are the ones who are blessed and prospered in the process of that. I can't think of any other entity in our culture, in our world. If you just look back to what he said, the verse part of chapter 4, and our culture is a mess. I don't have to tell you that. And that's why we have to live with a heart of worship that says, God, I'm so glad that you stand above this. I'm so glad that you're steady on your feet. You're not shuffling about. You're not stumbling back by all the stuff that's going on. And would you empower your church, starting with me, starting with you, us individually owning it and saying, God, we want to be the light of the world that's bringing your hope into this planet and into the reaches of experiences and expressions that we get to have. We begin to live with these words that the writer of Hebrews talks about, these beautiful words in chapter 10, verse 23. Says, let us hold unswervingly to this hope that we profess. That's Jesus. It's nothing but Jesus. It's Jesus plus nothing. He's our only hope. In the brokenness of humanity, there is no hope under the sun, period. But there is hope in the sun. And that's who we hold on to. Let's hold unswervingly to that, to him, to who he is. And let us consider how we might spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another all the more as we see the day approaching, the day where God's going to make it right one day, where this mess of humanity and the brokenness, God will finally deal with all that. I can't wait for that. But in the meantime, I'm invited in, and so are you, to not just play church, not just show up to church, but to be the church, a force and a movement set forth by Jesus, empowered by his love, empowered by his spirit, to say we're going to be the force that says enough. There is a different way. There is a different possibility. There is another potential to something better. And you may not see it take over everything at once, but one heart at a time, one life at a time, one city block at a time, it begins to gain influence and gain leverage. And pretty soon that becomes the pull on the human heart of those who are interacting and connecting with it. And the invitation goes out. You are welcome here. And you're invited to have a life-giving, life-changing relationship with Jesus, because he's our hope that we hold on to. And now let me encourage you to do good, to be a person who says, I'm going to find a way to serve. I'm going to find a way to share. I'm going to find a way to comfort. I'm going to find a way to protect. And as I do that, I'm living out this hope and life-giving message of Jesus and the movement of the church that he began. I love that we've been tasting that a little bit here and there. I love that we're getting to see that leveraged out in John B. Wright and here at Catalina in the lives of those who've been baptized over the last couple years. I love seeing the glimpses of it, don't you? Can we pray together that we would see more and more of that? Because our world needs it. A watching and waiting world sees life under the sun and there is no hope. There's glimpses of glamour that quickly fade and have a shelf life to them. But what Solomon is saying is there's something better. And it's when the church begins to live out and be the church. And so as we continue to find expressions and experiences of how we can live that out here in our community, here in our city, and even around the world, would you join with me and join us together that we're going to commit our hearts the best we know how to be the church? And so that's what I want to pray for. We're going to move toward a time of communion. And if you're new here, we kind of do communion on your own. And we have a table here in the middle. There's a couple, and there's a couple down here. And we're going to give you some space to kind of take communion on your own. And you're welcome to do that. You're welcome just to sit and reflect a little bit. You know, who has shared? Who has served you? Who has comforted you? Who's protected you? Maybe this week it's a week of saying, hey, I'm going to reach out and say thanks to them. Maybe this is a week where God's stirring up who you're going to step into and be a part of that in their life. And this week, you're going to find action steps to how to do that. Maybe this week is a week where we as a church commit together to say, God, we want to be a part of the movement that you have launched and you established as your church to invite people into a life-giving relationship with you by being the church, not just talking about it. And so, Father, I pray as we move toward a time of communion, as we worship here in a couple songs, would you continue to stir our hearts? This is heavy stuff. It's not easy, but I think each one of us can identify with the brokenness of humanity and just the yuck that we see, and that we have a yearning and a longing for something more. And so this invitation for us to worship you, to be captivated by you, to let our words be few, that we get to come boldly before you, but at the same token, we're called to come before you with great humility. We thank you again that you sit sovereignly over all of this, that you understand getting connected and living a connected life as you sent a Savior to live among us, to walk among us, to model a way, to give his life as a sacrifice for us, the forgiveness of our sins and the invitation that we can have life with you. You didn't send a message. You sent yourself. As Eugene Peterson says, you moved into the neighborhood that we might see you and experience you and taste and see that you're good. And so as we remember Jesus in this communion time, as we sing to you, would you stir our hearts, maybe reflecting on who has been a part of our life that we want to reach out and say thank you to, and maybe who you're putting across our path that you want to leverage our life and this pull of community into their life. Pray that we take action on that this week. And would you continue to bless our church and move us forward to be the church, your expression of hope in this world for people to see, to experience, to find, to grab handles to and know. We love you, Jesus.